Your weekend begins in Crystal Palate's Wine Country with sommelier Crystal Cameron Shad. Every week, Crystal takes your palate on a journey from the vineyard to the glass and opens your mind to the endless choices that await your next sip. Uncork your passion starting now on your trip through Wine Country on Seaville 107.5 and 1260 WCHV.
It's all about bubbles on this edition of Crystal Palate's Wine Country. With so many celebrations this time of year and a big ball drop on New Year's Eve in just a few weeks, I thought this was the perfect time to talk with Alan Tardy, the U.S. Ambassador from Prosecco and author of Champagne Uncorked. Alan is also the author of Romancing the Vine, Life, Love, and Transformation in the Vineyards of Barolo, and he's a regular contributor for the New York Times, Wine Spectator, and Decanter, just to name a few. He's also worked as a chef, sommelier, and consultant for many restaurants in New York City. And today, we're taking a deep dive into Prosecco, the region, the grape, and the extraordinary value from this part of the world. While Prosecco is one of the most popular sparkling wines in the marketplace, it's easygoing with lots of luscious fruit and crisp acidity. It's often misunderstood, and it doesn't quite get the respect it deserves, especially for the higher-end single vineyard selections. To help us in our quest to better understand the sparkling nectar is Alan Tardy. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Crystal. I'm happy to be here.
We met a few weeks ago at one of your master classes on Prosecco Superiore, and you can correct me if I didn't say that right, at the Capitol.
That was close to perfect.
Perfect. A little practice makes perfect. But we met at the Capitol Wine School in D.C. a couple of weeks ago, and I was really amazed by the stylistic differences between the many types of Prosecco and the tremendous value you can find in top-tier Prosecco in comparison to some of its higher-priced counterparts like Champagne and even Franciacorta. And we'll certainly talk about all of that on the show. But first, I want to start with a little historical perspective. Now, I learned from you that the first written reference to Prosecco was in a poem about Venetian wine dating back to 1754. But It is believed that the beginnings of Prosecco were actually predate the mid-18th century. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a historical context on this wine and the region?
Well, you know, many people think of Prosecco as a relatively new wine. In fact, it's quite old. One might even say ancient. The primary grape variety that's used to make it, which was originally called Prosecco, it's thought to have come from the Middle East. It definitely passed through this area of Trieste, which there is a village there called Prosec, which we think is where the name came from of the vine that wound up in just north of Venice in the hills of Conegliano Valdobbiadene. But it's very ancient, and chances are that this vine was being cultivated in this area going back to, well, I would say Roman times, but probably even before. And the first real reference to it was in the journal of an English traveler. I believe it was in 1493. His name was Fiennes. So it's really quite old. And, you know, with grape vines, you never really know for sure exactly where they started and when. But this one has definitely been around for a very long time in this particular area. You know, the vine has been around almost since the beginning of human civilization. Mm-hmm. We think that it was one of the first agricultural products to really be cultivated. That is, you know, before agriculture, people would forage in the woods and valleys and find different things they could eat. It seems that the grapevine was one of the first plants to really be cultivated, that is, grown in one specific place, so that people didn't have to move around nomadically looking for food. So it's really the grapevine is about as old as human civilization is. From there, because the grapevine has an incredible capacity to morph and change its characteristics and even its DNA based on its environment, there branches out into many, many different sub-varieties of Vitis vinifera.
And sure, that would take up a whole other show. Maybe we'll have you back on and talk about that, right? Because we're going back.
It's a fascinating topic.
It really is. It really is very fascinating. But for the sake of our purposes, we're talking about Vitis vinifera and we're talking about Prosecco. And I want to kind of fast forward from the historical perspective to 2009, because that was really a critical turning point in that particular region for Prosecco as a brand.
Well, I would even say for the world in some ways. Of course, Prosecco is an area, so it can only be grown in the northeast of Italy. But and where it was born was in this very small area up in the hills north of Venice that is defined. It's named after two towns. One is Conegliano and the other is Valdobbiadene. Prosecco had been made there for a long time. Most of it was consumed locally until after World War II, when in the economic resurgence of Italy, a lot of people, young men mostly coming back from the war, started to try to revitalize their family wine operations. And this is when the technology of the autoclave, which is a way of conducting the second fermentation to make the wine sparkling, which was really developed for the wines in that area at the Enology School of Conegliano. After World War II was when this technology was really diffused throughout the area, and that's when the production of Prosecco really took off. And as we all know, I think it went from there to become incredibly popular throughout the world. But there was a problem. As world demand grew, so did the need to produce more wine. The Conegliano Valdobbiadene area is very small, and it's all up in hills, incredibly labor intensive. So in 2009, everyone knew Prosecco throughout the world by that point, but the name was not really protected, and it was not tied to its growing area. And one of the chief reasons for that is that Prosecco meant a grape variety, a wine made from that grape variety, and the place in which it was produced. But you can't really protect a viticultural area that has the name of a grape variety. So if you think about it, there's no place in the world, a growing area that's protected wine growing area called Chardonnay, because you can make a wine from Chardonnay wherever that grape will grow.
Right.
So they had to make some changes. One of the big changes was they had a change in the name of the grape variety from Prosecco to an old local synonym for the word called Glera. So now the grape that used to be known as Prosecco is now called Glera. And that way they were able to use that very popular name to define the Prosecco area. But they also had to do something else. Because the wine was so popular by that point throughout the world, the little area of Conegliano Valdobbiadene could never completely supply the demand. So they had to create an entirely new area to grow and produce the wine called Prosecco DOC. And unlike the original area, this is a huge area that comprises two regions of Italy and nine entire provinces, more than 550 villages. So this is a big area compared to the small original one that has 15 sleepy little villages in it.
And we're going to talk about the distinction between the two coming up in just a few minutes. We're going to take a quick short break. And when we're back with Alan, he's going to tell you all about the differences between Prosecco Superiore, DOCG, and Prosecco DOC. And we're going to talk a little bit about the quality designations on Italian wine labels, because I think that is something that a lot of consumers get a little confused by. Stay with us. You're listening to Crystal Palate's Wine Country.
Oh, I love the sounds of fall in Virginia.
The leaves rustling, football games,
corks popping, glasses filling,
wine sipping.
I love wine sipping. It's like singing, only without sound.
Okay, let's hear it again.
Fall is the perfect time for Virginia wine. Visit virginiawine.org to discover your local crush.
Welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for staying with us. If you're just tuning in, Alan Tardy, the food and wine writer, he's a food and wine writer, and he's also the U.S. Ambassador for Prosecco Superiore, is with us today, giving us a little lesson in bubbly, particularly Prosecco. And when we think of Prosecco, I think the average wine consumer, they love Prosecco. It's so, it's so approachable, it's easy, it's affordable. But I think the big thing we really want to get across today is that there's more than one Prosecco region, and there's a lot of different distinction between the quality levels in these regions. So I know you want to talk a little bit about Prosecco Superiore DOCG from Conegliano Valdobbiadene. Is that close?
That's pretty close.
Okay, say it again, because you say it better.
Well, I've had more practice.
I know you have. I've been working on it all week, Alan.
It's pronounced Conegliano Valdobbiadene.
Okay.
So anytime in Italian, anytime you see a GLI, It's not pronounced gli, it's pronounced yi.
Yi. Okay, that's a good advice.
That's very consistent.
Like that pasta too, right? The tagliatelle?
Tagliatelle.
Exactly. Okay. So I know you want to talk about the difference between the DOCG and Prosecco DOC chief among those. And I think, you know, when people are going to the wine shop and they're told by one of their friends to pick up a bottle of Prosecco, or that's what they're making mimosas, they just grab any old bottle off the shelf. And when I took your class a few weeks ago in D.C., I was really amazed. I think you laid out 8 or 9 different type, and yeah. I was really impressed by the stylistic differences. So I'm going to let you jump right into it and tell our listeners the difference between the two.
Yeah, well, there are a number of differences. I mean, I think first we should just reiterate the fact that once upon a time, up until about 7 years ago or so, there was only one Prosecco area. Up in the hills of this place called Conigliano Valdobbiadene, which are the name of two villages there, just north of Venice. This is where Prosecco, as we know it, was born and produced. In 2009, for the reasons that we discussed in the first segment, an entirely new growing area for Prosecco was created. It's like a big sort of sea surrounding the small little dot, which is Conigliano Valdobbiadene. This is the Prosecco DOC area that was created in 2009. Now, the difference is, and so, you could say, okay, who cares? They're mm-hmm. both Prosecco, right? Well, they are, but there are some really fundamental differences between them. First of all, there's a big difference that has to do with size. We talked a little bit about that before, but the Prosecco DOC area is very large. It encompasses two different regions of Italy, the Veneto and Friuli, which is a very expansive area compared to the original one, which is very small. But even more than that, what the real fundamental difference is the growing area itself. The original area is all up in the hills. It's really the hills that define it. Sometimes very, very steep hills, sometimes kind of gentle hills on the eastern side, but it has to be up in the hills. Where the hills stop, the Conigliano Valdobbiadene area stops as well, and then surrounding that is the DOC. So most of the DOC is located in flat plains and valleys. Now, we call the sparkling version of the Prosecco from this area of Conigliano Valdobbiadene Superiore. So that's a good way to identify it. Most of the wines you'll see from this area will be labeled as Conigliano Valdobbiadene Prosecco Superiore DOCG. I know it's kind of long, but...
But if you look at that longer label, people are going to realize, especially to look for the DOCG. And speaking of, we're going to jump back into some of the stylistic differences, but I did want to touch real quickly on the quality designations between DOC and DOCG as far as a labeling perspective.
Okay. And that's a really good question. Now, this is something that pertains to all wines in Italy. So in France, they have the AOC system, the Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, mm-hmm. system that was created in 1936, actually, the official AOC system was created. And so the Italian system, which was created in 1963, I believe, is modeled on that. Instead of AOC, they call it DOC. So that's the Denominazione di Origine Controllata. So it just means controlled place name of origin. Mm-hmm. So if you want to call a wine by a certain name, it has to come from the area that defines it. So in Italy, when they created the system, they took it one step further. So you have the DOC, and then there's also something called DOCG. So the G stands for garantita, or guaranteed. Now, I mean, that's not a guarantee that you're necessarily going to love the wine or prefer it over a DOC. What it does mean is that the regulations that are required in order to use that category are much more stringent. And the reason that they're more stringent has to do with aiming for a higher level of quality. So when I say more stringent, usually if you have a DOCG, there are much stricter regulations concerning the location in which the wine can be produced, the time of aging that might be required for it. It's different with each wine because each wine is a little bit different, but the yield per hectare of grapes that you can legally harvest for a DOCG is typically less than it would be for a DOC wine. So So it just means much, much stricter, much tighter regulations.
It pretty much means, if you will,
try to ensure a higher level of quality.
No, absolutely. And I think when you're looking at the label, when you see the DOCG, it also has a strip with a number on it too, right? To guarantee.
Well, yes. And now that's actually true for I think all wines. Originally, it was the DOCG. That was one of the things that really set it apart. Was there was a DOCG strip with a code number on it that could all be traceable, because these things really are enforced. But now they've really amplified that, so that there's also a strip for DOC wines. It's just a different color. You know, wine is what really distinguishes and to me defines wine as a product, is that it's something that it expresses a particular place, the place where the grapes used to make it were grown and where the wine was produced. So it just goes without saying that if wine is an expression, a product of the place that it comes from, the more interesting, the more complex, the geologically speaking, the place, the more interesting the wine is probably going to be. And grapevines really do like hills for many reasons. I mean, one, the exposition to the exposure to the sun. Tends to be much better on a hillside than in a valley. In a valley, the sun beats down on the top of the vines. On a hill, it's like almost like a row of bleachers, where, you know, if you're sitting in a row of bleachers, you have a great vision to whatever you're the game or the movie screen or whatever it is you're watching. Vines that are on a hill have a great view towards the sun, so they can get good sunlight, good exposure, but there's also great ventilation, because they're not all kind of clustered in a flat area, like a bunch of people in a closed place. Mm-hmm. So the vines get great ventilation, great sunlight. There's also really good. Vines need water to live, but not too much water.
Right.
So it's on a hillside. They get great drainage because they're on a slope. And if you look at the hills of this area of Valdobbiadene, especially Conegliano too, but Valdobbiadene has many, many different aspects and different exposure of the hills. So the geology is very complex, and that really creates tremendous diversity in the grapes that come from that area.
And if you look at the greatest wine regions in the world, like Burgundy and Champagne, you have those different appellations, you have different crus, Premier crus and Grand crus, and yes. You're seeing the same thing with Prosecco. And I do want to talk a little bit about, from a consumer perspective, stylistically, what are we looking for in terms of style when we're looking at a label, in addition to the DOC and DOCG?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, I think a lot of times people are totally confused by Italian wine labels. And in some cases, I can understand that. With Italy, part of the complexity comes from the fact that it's such a rich tradition and history of winemaking that there's a lot of stuff to put on there. Now, with Prosecco, there are, besides looking for a wine from Conegliano Valdobbiadene DOCG, Superiore would be a sparkling wine. There are many other possibilities there. With Prosecco DOC or DOCG, it doesn't matter. It can come in different levels of residual sugar. Mm-hmm. And residual sugar means simply the wine that is left in the sugar that's left in the wine after the second fermentation has been completed, and the wine is sparkling. So there are different levels of residual sugar. The driest, so it gets, and here it gets very confusing, because you could see there are three different categories of residual sugar: dry, extra dry, and brut. Dry, ironically, is actually the sweetest one, and we measure it in grams of sugar per liter. So the dry Prosecco, anywhere from 17 to 32 grams of residual sugar per liter. So that makes it, kind of moderately sweet.
And to make things even more confusing, I think, Alan, is that dry, it pertains to Prosecco, not Champagne. So dry is going to be your sweetest version of Prosecco.
Yes, but however, in Champagne, they have a similar, it's really exactly the same system as Champagne. It's just that nowadays, the vast majority of Champagne is brut.
Right.
We expect that. But there is also, originally Champagne, just like Prosecco originally, was overwhelmingly a sweet wine. And so even to this day, if you ever see the word sec, mm-hmm. which on a bottle of Prosecco, a bottle of Champagne, sec means dry in French. If you ever see a sec on a bottle of Champagne, it's not going to be a dry wine. It's going to be quite sweet.
Right. So when you say demi-sec,
it's really the same
right.
category. It's just what throws us off with Prosecco is that instead of saying secco, which would be dry in Italian, it says dry, which, you know, we look at it and we think, oh, this is going to be a dry wine, but it's not.
So that's an important thing when you're heading out, especially this time of year. You're doing a lot of holiday celebrations and parties, and you're looking for kind of those crowd pleasers. So you kind of want to know what you're buying.
Absolutely. No, and people people really deserve to. And unfortunately, depends on which wine shop you go to, but you might not always get the help you need. I just out of curiosity, I went into a wine shop once, and I saw a bottle of Prosecco dry on the shelf, and I asked the salesperson, I said, well, is this a dry wine? He said, oh, yeah, see, it's just dry right there, but it's a little misleading because that's actually a sweeter one. So you have to really look for one of those categories. If you're really looking for a dry wine, you would look for a Brut. So you would see a Prosecco Superiore that says Brut on it, which means it's going to have anywhere from 0 to 12 grams of residual sugar.
And that's a good takeaway.
Dry is the sweetest, and then extra dry is kind of in the middle.
Okay. And when we did your tasting up at the Capital Wine School, I was surprised to see that there were some older vintages as well. And we don't normally think of vintages when we think of Prosecco. We think of the bread and butter, non-vintage wines, but there are vintages in Prosecco.
Absolutely. There's kind of a misconception on the part of many people that Prosecco has to be drunk as a young wine within a year or two of being made, which is really not necessarily true. Like any other wine, Prosecco from the Serre Cornigliano Valdobbiadene does have an evolution. So in the beginning, if you get it, you know, if you're drinking a younger one within a year or two of the vintage, it's going to be very kind of vivacious, very fresh, very crisp, very young. You can feel the youth in it. After a few years, and I think we in Washington we tasted one that was 4 or 5 years old, it gets kind of it mellows out. It gets sort of more mature, kind of calmer flavors. The aromas are a little bit subtler, but it's a little bit richer on the palate. So it's not necessarily something to shy away from by any means. It's just a wine that has a little bit more evolution to it, perhaps a little bit more complexity rather than just that forward fruitiness and freshness. And there is such a thing, as many people are not aware, there is such a thing as a vintage Prosecco. So you can have a Prosecco that will have the vintage date stamped on it, meaning that all the grapes come from that one particular vintage. Just like in Champagne, you can have a non-vintage Champagne. Many of them, I mean, historically, they were all non-vintage. They were all blends. There's also something that people can look for if they're looking for a little bit more. I mean, if you have a Prosecco from Cornigliano Valdobbiadene, it's already a very small, specific area, and you know it's up in the hills. If you want to go a little bit more into specifics of geography within that small area, in 2009, they also created something called Rive. It's R-I-V-E. And these are small geographical designations that have to do with either a village or a hamlet, a small community within a village. So if you ever see a Prosecco that has the word Rive on it, followed by the name of the town or the hamlet that it comes from, all the grapes have to come from that one particular place. So it has a little bit more of site-specific personality to it.
That's really good to know, and I always recommend, too, when I'm talking with different people and they want to really learn about wine or how to tell the differences between, you know, two Chardonnays from two different areas or Prosecco or whatever the wine may be, blind taste some of your friends. Get a couple different bottles. Go ahead and get
Absolutely.
A DOC, get a DOCG, and then pour it blindly. Let people try and see which one you like better, and I think that's where you really learn when you do it side by side.
You know, and Chris, I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's the only way to learn. I mean, we can talk about wine all we want, or people can read about wine, and that's all great, and it's nice to have some insight into it. But at the end of the day, you have to taste it. And if you have the opportunity to taste some, you know, a few different wines from the same general area that are different categories side by side, that's great, because then you can really see what the differences are, and you can see what you like best. And ultimately, what you like best is really going to be the best wine for you, regardless of what any expert says or how pretty the label looks or what kind of reviews or points it got.
That is so important.
That's really the best way to learn about wine.
Getting to know your palate and drinking what you like, but also being open to try new things is something I preach all the time, because there are so many things to choose from. But, you know, learn your own palate and drink what you really like to drink and be open.
And trust your own palate, because we are all our own walking wine experts.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's always great to talk to people who, you know, who maybe have tasted more wines than you or have had more experience. That's always great. But But nobody can tell you what you like or should like more than anything else. So, I mean, you have to be able to trust your palate as well. And because that ultimately that's what it's all about. It's very subjective. It's very personal. And not only that, our tastes, our own individual tastes are always changing. I mean, if you think about it, we don't like the same kind of things now that we did when we were children, you know? So our tastes and our palates change over time as well. So like you said, I mean, by all means, be open to different things. You try it. Maybe it's something new. You might not even like it at first, but it might be interesting or kind of be curious to you, and you might want to go back and try it again. And, you know, something might change. I mean, nowadays, many people are in sparkling wine, whether it's champagne or Prosecco or anything else, are going more and more towards drier and drier wines. So there's a category called extra brut, which is less than 6 grams of sugar per liter. Or there's a category called brut nature, which has no residual sugar, no measurable residual sugar whatsoever. And those are very dry wines that, you know, some people might not like at first. Give it a try. Absolutely.
And what a great time to try. As you know, we're heading right into the holiday season, lots of parties, got New Year's Eve coming up. What would be your recommendation? What are maybe the top three recommendations for New Year's Eve sparkling wine?
Oh my gosh. That's tough. I love wine. I love Prosecco, but you know, I like wines that tell a story. I like wines that express where they come from, what grape varieties they're made from, who and who made it. I like, you know, the personality of a wine. So sometimes the more specific, the better. Certainly in Prosecco, now, there's nothing wrong with the DOC at all. If you're looking for simple, kind of, you know, pleasant but not memorable quaffing sparkling wine at a very affordable price, go for a Prosecco. I shouldn't say this. I'm the ambassador of Prosecco DOCG, but there's nothing wrong with the DOC if that's what you're looking for. If you're looking for something with a little bit more personality and slightly more complexity and, you know, different diversity that expresses a particular part of this hilly area or even a specific topology, and there are a number of different ones there, then you might really be interested in seeking out some of these Prosecco Superiores from Cornigliano Valle Biadene, and maybe even finding some of the Rive. In Champagne, now we have a whole new class of champagnes that are called grower champagnes. So instead of being one of the big kind of maison, the big champagne houses, these are individual grower producers who grow the grapes and make their wine out of them. And they tend to have a lot more, well, I shouldn't say this, they tend to have a different kind of personality than the sort of larger personality of a very large producer, because they're tending their own grapes and making their own wine in much smaller quantities, so they have a different kind of personality. Also in Champagne, you know, we're used to kind of the wines that are made from the three principal grape varieties there, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Meunier. But there are actually four other grape varieties that are recognized and permitted for the area that are kind of referred to as the lost grape varieties because they were very peripheral, and they still are very peripheral, but those can be some very interesting wines wines made from those grapes can be some very interesting things to seek out if you can find any of those.
So many things to choose from. Believe it or not, Alan, we are out of time. This went by way too fast. You are also author of Champagne Uncorked. I encourage you to check out that book to learn more about champagne. He really is a true sparkling wine expert. You can check him out on his website, alantardi.com. That is T-A-R-D-I, alantardi.com. Alan, pleasure having you on. I wish you the happiest of holidays.
Thank you. Same to you. And I hope everybody enjoys some nice sparkling wine with their holidays.
Cheers.
Thank you.